University of California Television presents this podcast of the Von Liebig Forum featuring Bill Wolf, President of the National Academy of Engineering and the Vice Chair of the National Research Council, in conversation with Paul Kedrowski of UCSD's Jacobs School of Engineering. This program was recorded at UCSD in January 2006. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Today, we're fortunate to have with us Dr. William A. Wolf, who's the current president of the National Academy of Engineering. He's been the president since 1997. He is our advocate before Congress, frequently is called on for testimony promoting the technological health of the nation. You can easily review Bill's CV using your browser, so I'll not go through those details. But I would like to highlight some of his technological credentials and also provide a couple of personal observations about him before his lecture. His career spans public service, academia, and the formation of a startup company based on his own research. His research has focused in the computer science area where he got his PhD. In fact, he received the first PhD degree offered by the University of Virginia. His work has focused on computer architecture, computer security, programming languages, and optimizing compilers. One of the things I've often heard him say is that he loves his work, and I think he would endorse Catherine Graham's comments. Catherine was the owner and publisher of the Washington Post. Catherine said, "To love what you do, to know that it matters, what could be more fun?" And I think that exemplifies how Bill has been as president of the Academy. He's also a family man, and he loves gardening. At least that's what I'm told by his staff, as they are the beneficiaries of many of his products. Today, Bill will be gardening here in the Von Liebig Forum and speaking to us on incentives for innovation. Please help me welcome Bill Wolf to the podium.
Well, thank you very much, John. As he said, my topic today is to talk about what we need to do to prosper in the 21st century. Before I do that, let me just add one word or two to John's description of the Academy. It is, as he said, like academies elsewhere in the world, an honorific organization. You can't join. You have to be elected by the existing membership. John is a member. And it's generally considered to be the highest honor that can be bestowed upon an engineer by his or her peers. But when, and he said we were created in 1964, we spun out of the National Academy of Sciences. But we operate under the same congressional charter as the National Academy of Sciences. And that charter, I like to say, congressionally calls upon us to be schizophrenic. On the one hand, we are indeed an honorific organization like other academies. But on the other hand, the charter calls on us to provide advice to the nation on issues of science and technology. And that actually, from a point of view of my time or point of view of the effort at the Academy, is the predominant thing that we do. We produce advice which is recognized to be unbiased, independent, absolutely authoritative. Our customers are the White House, the Congress, executive branch agencies, occasionally the judiciary. Topics span an enormous spectrum: healthcare, terrorism, the economy, the environment. Electronic voting is one that we happen to be working on at the moment. A whole bunch of international activities and so on. So it's in that context of being an advisor to the nation that I really want to talk to you today about prospering in the 21st century. I think I need to start by saying, you know, that sounds like kind of an odd topic. By any rational measure that you want to take today, the United States is doing very well, thank you. As we like to say, we are the world's one remaining superpower. We have the largest economy in the world. That economy is growing at quite respectable pace, certainly better than most of the rest of the developed world. And despite that growth, we have relatively low unemployment and relatively low inflation. We're leaders in most areas of science and technology. So what's your problem, Wolf? Well, the problem is that those absolute values are all true. The trouble is that there are some disturbing trends about the future. And I'll talk at some length about those in a minute. But what we're all about is trying to advise the nation on what it needs to do now in order to correct those negative indicators and allow us to continue to prosper in the future. Now, many of us have long thought that for a variety of reasons, the United States has been a particularly fertile environment for the innovation that's led to this prosperity that we're currently enjoying. Our great research universities have produced both great ideas and the people who could implement those ideas into practical devices, processes that improve our quality of life. There's been a ready supply of patient capital, and we have actually something I think that we don't stress enough. We have a culture that encourages risk-taking. We have a culture in which it's okay to fail. Not too often, but it's a culture which recognizes that even failure teaches people things. The world's not a static place, however. And a number of recent books and reports have begun to raise warning signs that maybe the status quo, maybe the things, the behaviors that got us to where we are now are not going to serve us to continue our prosperity in the 21st century. I suspect that everybody here has either read Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat, or at least has heard extensive discussions of it. But just in case there's some odd person here who hasn't, his premise is that the economic playing field has become much leveler, in his terms, much flatter in recent years. Offshoring, outsourcing, and Lou Dobbs' exporting of America are all manifestations of that. And it's happened because it has become technologically possible to have call centers in the Philippines, to coordinate the complex supply chains that allows manufacturing in China, to do back office work in India, including having Indian radiologists read x-rays that were taken in the United States the day before. Now, Friedman's not the first person who raised this set of concerns, and frankly, I don't think his reasoning is always impeccable either. But he certainly has, I think, served a very useful purpose in capturing the attention of the country in a way that his predecessors has not. By the way, in the book, Friedman lists 10 flatteners, 10 things that made it possible to have a more level playing field. 9 of those things are technologies that we engineers created. That is, we engineers created the possibility of this flatter world, which a lot of people are describing now as a serious potential problem for the United States. Friedman himself argues that although there are dangers, on the whole, both economically and geopolitically, this trend to a flat world is a good thing. Lower costs benefit the developed country, consumer and shareholder alike. A rising middle class in India and China become consumers of their own products and ours as well. That same rising middle class has a growing stake in a frictionless international commerce, and hence in stability, peace, and the rule of law. But, he says, there will be transition problems, and whether global flatness is good for any particular country depends on whether that country is prepared to compete in the rough and tumble of this new flat world. What really grabbed me, however, was something at the very end of chapter 6 of Friedman's book. Chapter 6 is where he's describing what it is that a country needs to do in order to compete in this rough and tumble world. Let me read you just a couple of sentences. But have we, meaning the United States, but have we really been investing in our future and preparing our children the way that we need to for the race ahead? See the next chapter. But here's a quick hint. The answer is no. That's the concern. Reading that and putting it together with the fact that we engineers created the technologies that enabled this flat world makes me think that we engineers have more than our share of responsibility for shaping what the United States does in the very near term to prepare to play on that flat field. Now, Friedman's book is only one of a growing chorus of very similar concerns. I actually counted about 15 reports that have been produced over the last 2 years. They come from the private sector, the Business Roundtable, for example, the Council on Competitiveness. They come from government agencies, National Science Board, for example. They come from academic studies, and they come from the academies. The National Academy of Engineering released a report last summer called Engineering Research and America's Future. That report was chaired by Jim Duderstadt, the former president of the University of Michigan, and it documents the decline of research support over the last 20 years. Support for physical sciences and engineering has nearly halved as a percentage of gross domestic product. It documents the decline of U.S. students in the physical sciences and engineering. As a percentage of undergraduate students, the U.S. percentage of engineers is the lowest in the developed world. About 4 to 5% of our undergraduates are engineers, as compared with 12 to 13% in most of the EU, and of course, over 40% in China. As you all know, the US share of papers in both and patents is declining, and there's a lot of other data that I'll get to in just a minute that backs up this decline. The second report by the academies, in this case by all three academies together through our National Research Council, was released in October. It was chaired by NAE member Norm Augustine and had an absolutely stellar committee composed of current and former CEOs, current and former university presidents, several Nobel laureates, several former presidential appointees in previous administrations. The report is backed by copious data, and it points out that the basic message is the strategies that we employed to achieve our current leadership position are perhaps no longer sufficient and perhaps not even appropriate to the globalized world. I think that most Americans instinctively know that the way to prosper is to innovate. Yet that means change, and change is hard, especially when you're at the top. As Charles Darwin said, It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but rather the one most adaptable to change. And as Christensen said in his insightful book, which I really love, The Innovator's Dilemma, it is often the best-run companies, and I would say countries as well, that are the most resistant to change, to adopting new disruptive technologies. It's not an accident that of the 100 largest U.S. companies in 1900, very few are still on that list. In fact, over 60 of those top 100 companies do not exist anymore. Ironically, it seems that the most dangerous place to be seems to be at the top. And as I said before, I think that's true for both companies and countries. Therefore, the absolute dominant position that the United States has at the moment in some ways is comforting and in some ways is disconcerting. It's hard for the leaders to change because, after all, what got you here is what you've been doing. And there will be a whole cadre of people telling you that any change will be a disaster. So the cry is, circle the wagons, protect what you've got, opt for the status quo. Some of you may have seen a recent article that I wrote in The Bridge. The Bridge is the quarterly magazine from the National Academy of Engineering. In it, I try to classify or characterize a group of problems, none of which by itself reaches the status of a crisis. And we don't ever do anything in this country unless there's a crisis. But I think each one of those problems is more like a mosaic in a tile, a tile in a mosaic. When you stand back and you look at the pattern created by all of those problems, what emerges is a picture of short-term thinking, a picture of circling the wagons, preserving the status quo, a picture of a lack of long-term investment. In short, exactly the kind of thinking that Christensen argues dooms the industry-leading good companies, and they fail to adopt disruptive technologies. I don't have the time to discuss all of the tiles in that mosaic today, but some of the tiles include our loss of much of our industrial research capability, the decline of federal funding of physical sciences and engineering, the creation of the undefined notion of sensitive but unclassified information, the proposed handling of deemed exports, the increasingly short-term focus of the federal research that is funded, the visa policies that we have adopted affecting foreign-born students and scholars. And the list goes on. So what's to be done? I think there's wide agreement in the U.S. that our ability to innovate has been the principal cause of our prosperity. And hence, ensuring our ability to continue to innovate is central to our future prosperity. Each of the various 15-plus reports that I mentioned before proposes specific policy recommendations. None of them are identical. All of them are similar. Some of them cost money. Some of them don't. Some of them must be implemented by the federal government. Some of them we actually have control over. I'm putting my faculty hat on when I say we. I don't think this is the place to put out my own particular favorites, or those listed in the two reports from the academies that I mentioned. But let me say just a little bit. In my view, there is no simple formula for encouraging innovation. Instead, there's a multi-component environment that collectively encourages or discourages innovation. Just to mention a few components of that environment, there must be a vibrant research base. There must be an educated workforce. There must be a culture that permits and even encourages risk-taking. There must be a social climate that attracts the best and the brightest to practice engineering, whether from within the country or from abroad. There must be patient capital available to the entrepreneur. There must be tax laws that encourage investment. There must be adequate and appropriate protection for intellectual property. There must be laws and regulations that, while protecting the public, also encourage experimentation. We can and we should improve every one of those components. And if you look across the set of 15 reports, 16 reports, whatever it is, I think you'll find that virtually every one of the recommendations is aimed at strengthening, improving, modifying one or the other of the components of that list that I just read to you. Let me just pick out a few that I'd like to highlight. I am particularly concerned that the erosion of the research base in the physical sciences and engineering, coupled with what I perceive as an increasingly short-term focus, has the potential to do enormous damage. There have been I don't know how many studies in my lifetime that show it takes about 15 years for ideas to go from the research bench to product. That means that if we were to stop all research funding today, there's probably still a pipeline of ideas. And we, from a national perspective, wouldn't probably notice right away that something had gone awry. Equally, if we did that and then some number of years down the road decided that, oops, that was a mistake, and we switched it back on again, it would be a long time before those new ideas started to hit product. In fact, it would be worse because the most important side effect of research is the development of human capital, of the students who do that research. I think we sometimes tend to blame the federal government for that decline in federal research. I guess over the last 9 years, I'll have to say I live in Washington. You should not assume that that means I understand Washington. But I would make one observation, and that is that our representatives reflect their constituency very well. And so the lack of priority on physical sciences and engineering is a public problem. It's not just a government problem. Second, we must assure the quality of the workforce. And this is a case where that is our problem. That is something we can do something about. Sure, a little money would help. A little encouragement from the federal government would help. But to a first approximation, we can do a lot. We're not going to compete with the Chinese or the Indians on cost. So we had better compete on value. And that means that we need to think very hard about how we make our engineering, our engineers, and hence our engineering education, a factor of four or five more valuable. I've been on my soapbox about reform of engineering education ever since I came to the academy. But I have never seen so clearly the urgency of engineering education reform. One of my heroes is Bob Galvin. Bob was CEO of Motorola. He was one of the people who most clearly and earliest recognized the incredible need for the United States' manufacturing capability to focus on quality. We were about to get our lunch eaten by the Japanese on the quality issue. And I'll never forget actually talking about engineering education. Bob piped up and said he had never seen a process that could not be speeded up by a factor of two while simultaneously improving quality. That's the kind of goal that we need for engineering education. We need to be talking about how we produce in the first 2 years the student that we're currently graduating in four, and a better student at that. Third, I want to focus on the attractiveness of the social climate. Let me do this in two parts. One part dealing with U.S. students and then with foreign students. As I mentioned before, the fraction of U.S. undergraduates in engineering is between 4 and 5%, the lowest in the developed world. We produce, I'm gonna slide through this a little bit. There's a great deal of debate about how many engineers India and China are actually producing. If I take kind of a, and I've seen numbers for China, for example, which vary from 200,000 to 700,000. In a sense, it doesn't matter what it is. All of the numbers I've seen are much bigger than the United States. But if I take what numbers I think of as sort of reasonable, the United States is producing something like 7% of the world's engineers. Moreover, while engineering has been historically seen as a path of upward mobility for new immigrants, notably, our underrepresented minorities in this country are absent from our engineering classes. There's something about the image that we are projecting of engineering which is making it, and I'll say this in a blunt way, repulsive to the students that we need to come take engineering. I frankly think a lot of it is the boot camp style of our current curriculum. If you haven't seen it, there's a marvelous piece of scholarship done by two women at the University of Colorado. The book is called Talking About Leaving. And it documents in copious data the reasons why students in the physical sciences and mathematics, sorry, physical sciences and engineering, graduate at only about a 50% rate. It also documents the fact that although the comfortable myth that we have is that what we're doing is weeding out the poorer students, the data say that the students who leave are indistinguishable from those who stay. They have the same grade point average. They have the same grades in math and science. They have the same SAT scores. They have the same rank in high school. There's a an exit interview with a young woman who is leaving engineering after her second year to become a math major. So she's not opting out of engineering for some easier course. And it sort of captures for me what we need to do. She said, "I've been in engineering for 2 years. I have never seen an engineering professor. I have no idea what engineers do. I have only been taught by graduate students in physics, math, and chemistry who don't give a darn about me because I'm not a physics major or a math major or a chemistry major." I'll just leave you with that. Yes, I think we also have an image problem, and I think that image problem is largely an incorrect image. But nonetheless, I think we can do a lot about changing the uninviting image of an engineering education to one that is much more inviting. There are two universities in the country which graduate more engineers than enter in the freshman class. They actually attract students from the liberal arts and their quality programs. It is not necessary to have an uninviting program. So let me now turn to the social climate as perceived by the international students. I won't tell you the whole story, but you all know about the problems that we have been having with visas. I had a wake-up call experience this fall. I testified to the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee responsible for immigration. And I told them about all of the wonderful things that people born in other countries have contributed to this country and how we are more prosperous, more secure because of those contributions. And then I was just decked. It became clear that at least of those, when you testify, the whole committee is never there. Of the committee members that were there, it was clear that there was a majority that believed that every foreign student was a spy, that they were trying to bleed us dry of all the good technology, and one representative actually said this, that the country would be better off if we had no foreign students at all. Because after all, that would make room for all of those American students who want to get into college and can't. Okay. A bright spot on that horizon, however, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has relatively recently focused on this issue. And as you know, she was provost at Stanford. And so understands the academic culture and understands the contributions of foreign-born students. She gave a speech about 2 weeks ago in which she and the director of the Secretary of Homeland Security talked about making radical changes to not just fix the visa problem, but to make the United States a welcoming an inviting place to come. I don't know whether she will succeed, but it was one of the most encouraging speeches I've heard in a long time. For those of you who have not seen Rising Above the Gathering Storm, at the end of the executive summary, there's a list of worrisome facts. And that Norm Augustine has been adding to that list furiously. But there's one in there that I think we really need to pay attention to in this regard. There was a survey done in 17 countries. And there were about 1,000 people roughly surveyed in each country. So it's a presumably statistically valid survey. The question was, where would you advise your children to go These are all developing countries. Where would you advise your children to go to have a better quality of life? And only one of those 17 countries put the United States at the top of the list. That shook my self-image. I don't know about you. Finally, I want to say a little bit more about this multi-component environment for innovation. Talking with some folks recently made me realize that many of the components of that environment were invented for a technology that was, not for the technology that is or the technology that will be. Examples: the double-blind randomized test is the gold standard for the FDA. Okay, there are now coming online some ideas for personalized medicines, medicines that work for only a particular individual and a particular disease. In particular, there are some vaccines for cancer that I'm aware of that have that property. There's no way for them to get approved in the United States because they don't fit the double-blind randomized model. The intellectual property system that we have, patent system in particular, was designed back in the 18th and 19th century for physical machines with gears and pulleys and stuff. It's not immediately obvious to me that it's a perfect fit for snippets of DNA. The antitrust laws that were designed about 1900 or a little before to break up steel monopolies and railroad monopolies, I can tell you, demonstrably don't work for software companies. One of my goals for the remaining, I have a year and a half left in my second term, and then I'm toast. And one of my goals in that period of time is to put into motion a process to allow the academies to review those kinds of components of the innovation environment and look at them from a zero-based, let's ask the question, what if we were designing the patent system today, what would it look like? Not making incremental little tweaks to it. So let me conclude. I talked a lot, but my message is actually a simple one. The U.S. is enormously prosperous at the moment, in no small measure, because of the contributions of engineers. But in the process of developing that technology that made us so prosperous, we also enabled a flatter, more level playing field. That's generally a good thing. A rising tide really does lift all ships. A more generally prosperous world will be a safer one. But it does mean that the strategies that got us to where we are not necessarily the strategies that will keep us prosperous. Difficult and uncomfortable as it may be, we need to think about change. We need to think about how we can do things differently to compete on that flat, rough-and-tumble playing field. Some of what needs to be done is under our control. And so just sitting back and saying it's the government's problem, I think, is the wrong thing. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us. We have with us Dr. Bill Wolf, the president of the National Academy of Engineering, and we're going to continue a conversation about innovation and some of the challenges facing engineering going forward. And so what I thought would be interesting to do is sort of go backwards before we go forwards and sort of ask the question. I understand you're computer science, an early computer science graduate.
Yep.
From University of Virginia.
Virginia.
What sort of induced the young Bill Wolf to get into computer science and engineering in general, but computer science in particular?
There are two different answers to that. I can tell you the exact moment that I got hooked on engineering. Mm-hmm. I was between my second and third year. My father had been an engineer. My favorite uncle was an engineer, so I was sort of programmed to be an engineer. But that summer, I had a job drafting, doing inking on vellum, which is just about the worst job you can possibly imagine. But the group that I was working with was Teletype Corporation, was building an automatic phone dialer. And little plastic cards and fingers came out. And about every 20th card that would go through, it would bind and it would break the little fingers. And I can remember the exact moment that I looked up from my drafting table and I saw what was wrong and I saw how to fix it. And I actually mocked up the solution with cardboard and drafting tape. It worked the first time, never failed after that. And the thrill of that creative moment is when I got hooked on engineering. Computer science, it was a teacher, Lloyd Fosdick, University of Illinois. I took my first programming course on ILIAC 1, which was a 1950 hand-built tube machine. But Lloyd obviously recognized that I was enjoying it. He asked me to be a teaching assistant the second semester. That's when I got hooked on being an academic and a teacher. And he sat me down one day and said, "Where are you going to go to graduate school?" Well, I came from a rather poor family, and I didn't even know there was such a thing as graduate school. I didn't know there was such a thing as a PhD. And he just sort of took me by the scruff of the neck and said, "Do this."
So that took you full cycle. You decided that having gone that far down the path, you wanted to go all the way.
That's right.
Classic engineering. I don't want to stop halfway.
That's right.
Finish the whole process. So having gone through engineering and decided you wanted to be an academic, taking us a lot closer to the present, you've left engineering in a sense to take a more of a policy role at the National Academy of Engineering. In the world of academia, you're walking away from research and getting away closer to policy. Some people it's a frightening prospect, I think, for many academics.
Well, for me, it's a way of paying back. The system has been incredibly good to me. As I said, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a graduate school, yet I managed to get a PhD. I managed to be able to teach at fine places like Carnegie Mellon. Had the incredible experience of starting a company. Mm-hmm. And so, aside from the fact that this is the best job in the world, it was for me a way to pay back.
We talked earlier about this, but I mean, is there something that in looking back over your own career and some of the things that you've done, you talked about starting a company, that you think you could have, in looking back at your engineering education, that could have helped you better for? Is that one of the things that you're hoping that you look at engineering education today and try and think about how I could change it?
Nobody could have been less prepared for starting a company than I was. It was clearly the steepest learning curve of my life, and I clearly made an awful lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, the motivation is there. I hired a number of people who were my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon and my former students. And the motivation of making payroll for those people on Friday afternoon was really strong. I do think that somebody once defined for me invention is making something new. Innovation is making something new that people will buy. And that's a dimension of engineering that we don't teach in universities. What is it that really satisfies customer needs? Satisfies them so well that they're willing to part with their hard-earned money to be able to possess them.
Do you think that that's something, having done the company that you did, that you brought back into engineering with you, sort of that newly enlightened view of?
No question about it. I went back to teaching at the University of Virginia, and as someone described to me once, that was an interocular event. That means a 2x4 is between the eyes. Because it made me realize that most of my fellow faculty members had never practiced engineering and had some really strange ideas about what it was like to practice engineering. That's what got me interested in engineering education reform. And at Virginia, that manifested itself as a lot of effort to revise the computer science curriculum. But then when I got this bigger hammer called the presidency of the Academy of Engineering, I broadened my aspirations to engineering education.
Do you think, well, sort of following on in engineering education reform, do you think that's something that would help the discipline on teaching engineering, that if more people who are engineers, it was thought of as more of a clinical discipline, you know, almost in a medical sense, that people had practice as well as worked as academic engineers?
I mentioned the two schools that have a larger graduating class than freshman class. And the distinguishing characteristic of both of those programs, and it's not exclusive to those programs now, but the characteristic, well, there are two characteristics. One is that they both introduce the practice of engineering in the entire curriculum, starting in the first semester, as opposed to the capstone kind of project experience that many places have. The other characteristic is two really dedicated individuals who made it happen.
So, but taking it back, would you like to see almost a requirement or the NAA saying to universities that, you know, in hiring faculty, we would, you know, this is the kind of experience we would like people to have, or even more flexibility about universities saying to their faculty in areas that are inherently practical, like engineering, that, you know, we'd really love to see people spending more time outside?
A couple of reactions to that. First of all, the Academy has no power mm-hmm. to make anybody do anything. What we have tried to do is make it clear that the Academy values contributions to engineering education. I refer to this as Bill's four-legged stool. Leg one is we created a committee, which is what we always do. but they have produced some really important reports. The second thing is that we made contributions to engineering education be a valid criteria for election to the Academy. I saw no way you could say that we value contributions to engineering education, but just not enough to let you be elected to the Academy for that. Third, we now give a $500,000 prize for contributions to engineering education. And oh, by the way, the dean of the Jacobs School will be the chair of that committee next year. And finally, we created a center at the Academy called CASE, Center for the Advancement of Scholarship on Engineering Education. The Academy tends to advise other people to do things, but never to do anything itself. And I decided that this was a case where we ought to really be working on the scholarship of engineering education. We ought to not just be advising other people. We ought to be making active contributions to that scholarship. So I'm hoping we're setting an example. I'm hoping we're changing some attitudes. And actually, I think we are.
You talk, I think it was in a congressional testimony you were giving, you were talking about the sort of, there was a crisis in engineering, but there was no sort of Sputnik moment. Do you think that's part of, it creates a real challenge in terms of trying to communicate that there's a crisis, but I can't really point to one. You know, I think you used the analogy of the frog in the boiling water, that, you know, we're there and everything's changing and no one wants to do anything until you reach a crisis point.
That's why I have started to use this analogy to a mosaic. Mm-hmm. There isn't a Sputnik moment, but there are a lot of pieces, each one of which is subcritical, but they all have the same characteristic of being short-term focused, lack of long-term investment.
So let's get maybe a little more specific about some things then in terms of, you know, policy issues and others that sort of affect engineering and affect engineers. And, you know, one of the ones that's been in the press lately, there was an expose article in Fortune magazine about the Bayh-Dole Act and about the role that that's had in changing the way that commercialization happens in university campuses. I know you have some views about how some policies are kind of outdated because they're written for a prior world. Do you think that's been an effective piece of policy? Has that made the world of engineering a more grounded place?
I think that the Bayh-Dole Act was some of the best intended legislation that's ever been passed. I believe it really was the case, or is the case, that there's lots of neat technology and lots of neat technological ideas in universities that never makes it to commercialization. Unfortunately, as implemented on most campuses, it's not very useful. I was telling John earlier that I was in a meeting at the Academy a couple of years ago in which we had a mixture of industrial people, government people, and university people. And one of the industry people piped up and said, well, my company now has an official policy that we will no longer support research in American universities. Mm. As you can imagine, this caused a lot of drop jaws. He went on to say, look, it takes us 2 years to negotiate an intellectual property arrangement. And I can go to China and I can arrive on Monday, sign a contract on Tuesday, and get the work started on Wednesday. And in a world in which product cycles are 18 months, that time differential is so valuable that that my company cannot any longer afford to engage with American universities. Many of you may know that there's a new college called Olin College, which small, but is doing some interesting experimental things. And one of them is it has a policy that if it does research that is industrially funded, it gives all of the IP to the company. Hmm. It then reminds the company that universities depend upon philanthropy, and that might be an appropriate thing to do at some point in the future if, in fact, the technology turns out to be valuable. Mm-hmm. But it's not contractual. It's not legal. And I suspect it's going to be more effective.
Is the response, I mean, I've heard this response elsewhere, so I might as well repeat it, is that some would say that there isn't a crisis at all. It's really what we're seeing is kind of, I think you talk about Tom Friedman and this flattening effect. This is just sort of natural economics of developing countries rising up, and they rise faster than developed countries can progress. So there's always going to be the gap between the countries that first held advantage and others coming along is always going to decrease. It can't stay the same. And so this is this difference between the advantage that U.S. once held and it now holds in science is naturally going to dissipate.
Yeah, I actually think that the thing to focus on, I mean, we want developing countries to be fat and happy. We will be safer if they are. Mm-hmm. What we don't want is to have our own quality of life degrade. And it's not a zero-sum game. They can advance, and we can advance too. And it would be just wonderful if the quality of life around the world was sort of the same and good. What I'm concerned about, what I was trying to say here, is that it is possible that that's not what's going to happen, that we will actually slide, because we will be trying to use the techniques that got us to where we are to continue to stay prosperous. And that may not work.
Mm. But some of this is obviously just raw numbers. I mean, you know, it gets trotted around, and I suppose there's some confusion about how many, but, you know, as many as 700,000 engineers every year graduating in China, something 400,000 or 500,000 in India, and I think the number is something like 70,000. In the U.S., you know, to just sort of equivalent in your term, to bring into balance, the engineers demand here would have to be, you know, in the order of four or five times as productive, or produce four or five times as much value, for which seems unrealistic. How does that happen?
I'm not sure. I believe that is unrealistic. As I said before, one of the natural advantages that we have in the United States is that it's okay to fail, and that's just not true virtually any place else in the world. And so there is that natural value that we have. We're willing to experiment a little bit more than most other peoples.
You know, you talked about being better evangelists for engineering, to go out and, you know, convince someone who might otherwise, you know, God help them, go out and go into, you know, arts and there, instead of going into engineering, and talking to those people in a way that, you know, conveys some of this, you know, this passion, some of the things that are exciting, and some of the things that might drive more people to come into engineering.
Well, One of the messages that I try and convey all the time is I think that the essential characteristic of engineering and engineers is creativity. I think in many ways we have a lot more in common with our friends in the arts than we do with our friends in the sciences. There's an absolutely wonderful quote from Theodor von Karman. Von Karman was an aerospace engineer circa 40s and 50s. And he was the one who did the aerodynamic analysis on the bridge called the Galloping Gertie, that I think we've all probably seen movies of. He was trying to explain the difference between engineering and science. Usually I don't make that distinction very strongly because I think a lot of us in our career kind of move back and forth across that spectrum. But if you want to define the two ends of the spectrum, he said, science is about understanding nature, about understanding what is. Engineering is about creating what has never been. Every act of engineering is creating something that has never been before. And so I think the essential characteristic of a good engineer is creativity.
That's a wonderful note to end on. So thanks very much. We appreciate this. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.